Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Walt Bowman, and he'll be doing a session entitled American Revivalism and Christian Baptism. So let's listen in on Walt.
All right. There is some progression to what we have been doing. I've been trying to ask about the issues posed by the church growth movement, and so the first day we talked about what kind of a gospel does the church growth movement really presuppose, and it's quite clear that it presupposes an understanding of the gospel, the good news of Christianity, as, to put it in D. James Kennedy's terms, the answer that you must give to God when you die so he will let you into heaven. When one looks at the New Testament, however, and at the word gospel in the New Testament, one finds something quite different. The good news that something has happened, is news either about the reign of God, the coming of the kingdom of God, that's quite clearly what it is in Jesus' own proclamation, that the good news is the kingdom of God is at hand, it's coming, it's happening. And the good news of the first disciples of Jesus was not Jesus died for you, it was Jesus is risen and he is the Messiah. And that means the same thing as the kingdom of God has come. It means the messianic age is here. It's happening now. The church is not the same thing as the kingdom of God. The church is fundamentally called to be a witness to this good news. That is to say what it is that has happened. Now, one of the things we didn't have time to get into was, What if that is in fact the good news, Jesus is risen? Means everything is changed. It means that Jesus is in charge of the final future of the universe. It means life and not death will have the last word. I mean, if one listens to Stephen Hawking, for example, who is the most famous theoretical physicist and astrophysicist, and the one who's written a book, The Brief History of Time, which has sold into the millions of copies. Hawking thinks not only that death will have the last word, but that a big crunch is going to happen in which time will collapse in upon itself and we will all live our lives over again backwards. And therefore, we will end up worse than not having been. Well, no, I should say, we will. When you die, you are no more, right? When you die, you are no more. That's what it means that death has the last word. But if you live your life backwards, it means you will not have been at all, right? That's worse than not being anymore, it's zero, it's nothing. Well, that's a possible future, isn't it? What Christians say is, that's not our future. Our future is, death will not defeat Jesus, who is the Christ, not for him, not for us, not for the universe. And that changes everything. It changes now, and that's what we're going to talk about today. It changes the way we participate in the universe altogether. So that's the first day. I don't think that the Christian gospel is what the church growth movement perceives it to be. The second thing I tried to do yesterday is that it strikes me that church, we were talking about entertainment evangelism and the challenge that it raises. And I think Walter Kallestad and the people at Community Church of Joy and others, like the ones we watched on television on Monday or Tuesday, that these people have put their finger on a significant problem. The problem, however, may not quite be what they have identified. They have assumed that, in a sense, you who come to worship on Sunday are basically going to be an audience. And they're saying, whatever the church has been doing for that audience isn't working anymore. What we need to do is to find something that works. But you stay an audience. All of these church growth buildings presuppose that the people who come are essentially an audience. They want to do interesting and good things for that audience, but you're still an audience. The person who wrote, David Lukey, who wrote the sort of church growth book for Lutherans, I think it's called Lutheran Substance and Evangelical Style or whatever, consistently refers to the people who come together as an audience. And the problem is, that's what traditional liturgy has also done. It has treated people as if you were essentially an audience on which the clergy acted, or before which the clergy did a kind of show on Sunday morning. In fact, that was even what the medieval church did with the Mass. It turned the Mass into a kind of drama, and the great cathedrals that were built were essentially stages for the drama of the Mass. What I tried to say then yesterday is that church belongs essentially to gospel, and church is the people, and what we come together to do on Sunday is our work, our liturgy, the people's work. We come to do something that identifies us as the people of the New Age, the Messianic Age, whatever it is that God has in mind for the world, the Messianic Age, the coming of the Kingdom of God. The church is called to be, in a sense, the avant-garde, the advance, anticipating humanity. What all of humanity will look like, that's what the church is called to look like. And it belongs essentially to the gospel. If one looks, I could look at many passages, but the one I didn't read yesterday, it's so nice to have a chance to do a second shot at anything. When I was in seminary, I memorized a poem that goes, "By daylight when I wish to awe my friends with my acumen, how wittily I hem and haw, to err is only human. But when at night I lay abed and Morpheus treats me badly, the clever things I should have said come trooping to me gladly. Ah, what a killer I would be, how deucedly attractive, if repertoires of repartee were only retroactive." Well... So it's nice to have a second crack at things, because then you can sort of get in all the things you... Now, Ephesians, you know, this chapter, this great chapter that talks about how it is by grace that we are brought into God's salvation and not works. But then it goes on. "You Gentiles, you who were alienated outside of the commonwealth of Israel, you were far off, have been brought near. For he is our peace, and in his flesh he has made both groups, Jew and Gentile." That's the whole world, that's all of humanity. "Into one flesh, made them one body, broken down the dividing wall, the hostility between us, so that he might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross." So Ephesians quite clearly says the church is in a sense what it's all about, if one understands that church is the forerunner of a totally reconciled humanity. So being church belongs essentially to God's driving through history with the reign of God. It's not sort of accidentally there, and we are definitely not an audience to be acted upon. We are, in fact, the actors. And the way we act, the way we signal that we've got it, that we've caught on, is to do two things. One is to offer ourselves. See, to put ourselves at the disposal of the reign of God. That's why the offering is not passing the hat, defraying expenses, paying the minister, fixing the roof. The offering is putting ourselves at God's disposal for service to the reign of God. That means what we're doing in the offering determines the whole week long of one's life, one's existence. And the other thing that we do is celebrate the Messiah's banquet. That's what the Lord's Supper is. It is not an individualistic tete-a-tete with Christ. It is celebrating the meal, the messianic banquet. Again, last night's theme, Vespers, was about that. And what people need to see when they come is the church. The church is invisible unless and until it gathers to do what the church does. Visited a friend in Davis, California, who was the pastor there at that time, and we arrived in the middle of the week, and after lunch I said, "Well, can we see your church?" And he looked at me and he said, "Walter, we haven't got time." I said, "What do you mean? We've got all afternoon." He said, "Oh no, they're all over." He wasn't going to take me to an empty building. I could not see the church in an empty building. Do you understand? I mean, that was just one of the most powerful things anybody ever did to me. You cannot see the church when you look at an empty building. We would have had to go to homes and places of work and people who were traveling and people who were on vacation. We couldn't have seen his church if we'd have had the whole week, you see, until on Sunday they came together. Then I can see the church. Only if they are doing what the church does. And here, I wanted to quote yesterday again too, Paul from 1 Corinthians 11. When you come together as church, he says. You see, you can come together for lots of reasons. You can come together as PTA, or you can come together as labor union, or you can come together as board, or, I mean, they're all, you can come together as class. But when you come together as church, what are they doing? Well, Paul says they're supposed to be doing the Lord's Supper, but it isn't working because the people who have a little bit of money and who brought the food aren't sharing it with the poor. And if they're not sharing it with the poor, they've missed the whole point, you see, of this banquet. And therefore, he says, you might as well stay home and eat because you're not really church. And then what does he do? He tells them once more the story of Jesus, who sets the table with his own self-offering. You see, who doesn't ask, is the world worth it? Are you a bunch of crumbs worth it? You see, he just gives himself into death for the life of the world. And that meal, therefore, means we're not only at Messiah's banquet table, but we put ourselves on the table in order to be there for the world. You see, that's the meaning of this meal. And if we're going to show people what the Christian gospel is, there is such a thing as truth in advertising, you see. I mean, we're supposed to tell them what's really at issue. Don't be ashamed that among other things, you put yourself on the altar. That's what it's about. We're not trying to sort of elide people into Christianity, saying, well, it's really not so bad. It's bad. In many ways, it is everything that's at stake here. Oh, won't cost you much to join the church. Like nonsense. It costs everything to be a part of the church. We're putting ourselves on the table, and we are offering ourselves for the world. So when people come, that's what they need to experience. Well, now, how do we get there? American revivalism started earlier this week talking about Barton Stone. I brought along my copy of Harold Bloom's The American Religion. And this is easily one of the most interesting books I've read in the last few years. What he is saying is that the American religion was born in the Cane Ridge Revival put on by Barton Stone in Cane Ridge, Kentucky in August of 1801. Stone set the pattern for what I would call American revival religion, and if one wants to tell the story, you have to first of all imagine 15,000 to 20,000 people gathering at a single place like Cane Ridge, Kentucky, with all that was involved. It was an 18th century, 19th century Woodstock. Do you remember Woodstock 25 years ago? 500,000 people came to whatever it was, a place in New York, a farm. The sheer logistics of it are sort of staggering. But they were used to it. Then there was nonstop preaching. And the preaching was of a peculiar character. You preached sin as moral wrongdoing, and the judgment upon sin was you are going to hell. And then they preached salvation. Accept Jesus, stop sinning, accept Jesus, and you'll go to heaven when you die. That became the model for what later in the century, under Charles Grandison Finney, president of Oberlin College, became known as New Measures. Because what Finney tried to do was to take the revival, the camp meeting, and set it into the local congregation. He wanted every Sunday morning to be a revival. He wanted congregations to have sort of week-long revivals. And this became then the kind of classic model for the denomination known as Baptists, who turned Sunday morning into a revival, complete with its altar call and the choir in the background singing the hymns that became so familiar at revivals. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, sinner, O sinner, come home. Just as I am without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, etc. What a friend we have in Jesus. There's a whole canon of these hymns. I bet most of us know them, and I bet we've all sung them. We can sing them from memory right now. See, how many of you know all four verses of A Mighty Fortress? Probably none. But we could sing quite a few verses of Amazing Grace. That's another one. So the choir sings and the sinners come forward and make a decision for Christ. I had a former Baptist in my parish in Albany, New York, who didn't understand why we Lutherans were having the Lord's Supper every week. And I finally said to him, Paul, that's our altar call. And he said, oh, he said, I never thought of that. And then he became one of my most faithful communicants. Showed up at the altar every Sunday. But you see, that was the climax. I used to go down to Third Baptist in St. Louis to hear C. Oscar Johnson, the most flamboyant preacher in St. Louis at the time. And he was marvelous, and his altar calls were great, and people would stream forward, and he would pray over them, and then the next Sunday they'd come back again for the same altar call. But that was the whole pattern of worship. It was the revival transferred to the Sunday gathering of the community. After Finney came Dwight Lyman Moody, who started Moody Bible Institute in Chicago and who gentled down the preaching of sin so that it wasn't quite as vigorous, and so that it would be easier to accept Jesus as one's Savior. Let me get a couple of examples. After Moody came Billy Sunday, and Billy Sunday's appeal on the 12th day of his New York campaign was typical. Do you want God's blessing on you, your home, your church, your nation, on New York? If you do, raise your hands. How many of you men and women will jump to your feet, come down and say, Bill, here's my hand for God, for home, for my native land, to live and conquer for Christ? And Homer A. Roadheaver and his choir would begin their musical accompaniment as a sea of humanity surged forward, sometimes into the thousands of people. That kind of altar call, says Sidney Ahlstrom, great Yale church historian, the burden was easy and the sawdust trail was wide. All of this, says Ahlstrom, became increasingly popular in American religion. Since Sunday's attacks on high society, worldly amusements, filthy habits, pliable politicians, liberal preachers, trashy immigrants, and the booze traffic, every man who was not a teetotaler was a dirty, low-down, whiskey-soaked, beer-guzzling, bull-necked, foul-mouthed hypocrite. Whew! That's powerful language. Simply fostered the self-righteousness of his middle-class audiences. The high tide of this approach to evangelism was in the decade immediately prior to World War I. From 1914 to 17, there were more than 650 full-time and 1,300 part-time evangelists in the field. Tabernacle evangelism was the kind that Sinclair Lewis then satirized in his novel Elmer Gantry, if any of you've read it, or seen the movie for which Burt Lancaster won an Academy Award, I think. And after Sunday comes Billy Graham, who got his start in Los Angeles and who was puffed in the newspapers. There was a famous memo from William Randolph Hearst, Puff Graham. That is, blow him up, make him important. Graham started out as an anti-communist revivalist. Remember, this was the 1940s and 50s, and you could make quite a name for yourself. Now, one has to say that what Billy Graham has done, among other things, he read Elmer Gantry and practically memorized it so that he wouldn't be guilty of some of the things that Gantry was guilty of. He never enters a hotel room alone. Graham doesn't, among other things. Always make sure that there are other people with him. He's a deeply pious man and has scrupulously let his books open for audit. In fact, has challenged other evangelists to do the same. Graham is honest and has tried to be churchly as well, wants churches to sponsor his crusades and wants to refer the people who have made decisions to churches. It doesn't work all that well because American revivalism is basically, again, not churchly. Only 2% of the people who make decisions at Billy Graham Crusades ever affiliate with local congregations if they aren't already members. But he tries. I want to say all of that. He is, in a sense, the last in a great line of American revivalists. Now, there are two things I think to be said about this. The first is that the essential feature is the decision for Christ. And the second thing to be said is, baptism plays no role in this at all. Graham has written many books on becoming a Christian. Never once in any of those books has he ever mentioned baptism. Just doesn't deal with it at all. And And the fundamental thing is that one makes one's decision. Baptism is just drops out of the picture. The most of American Protestantism, the majority, I shouldn't say most, the majority of American Protestants belong to non-infant baptizing traditions. There are about 80 million Protestants in this country. 35 million of them are Baptists who do not baptize infants. If you add to that some of the holiness, most of the Pentecostal groups and the Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ, you end up with more than 50 to 55 million of the 80 million Protestants in this country do not baptize infants. And with that, says Harold Bloom, goes the notion that babies do not sin. That is, see, sin is understood in terms of what you do. It's not understood in terms of being part of a fallen humanity. You become a sinner by things that you do. And maybe by age 10 or 12, you've got enough so that you need baptism, you see, or you need conversion, or you need a decision. But certainly not. Bloom also links this with the strong anti-abortion appeal in certain fundamentalist and non-adult and non-infant baptizing traditions. Bloom's book, as I said, is easily one of the most interesting I've ever read. But one other thing needs to be said. The whole approach of revivalist religion is that it is made basically for the consumer. The pitch is such that heaven is made attractive enough and hell is made hot enough so that you really want to buy into it. It's also the kind of thing that is in the end made for television. You can sit at home and make your decision for Christ, you see. Now, what happens when something becomes a consumer product, even if Bill Hybels doesn't want it to be? Basically, the consumer is in charge. That's fundamentally what's at issue. My wife Jan went to buy a car a couple of years ago, and Luke coached her, our son Lucas coached her in doing all of this. You do all the things. You figure out what kind of a car you want, first of all. You decide what you want well before you ever go to the dealer. Then you write consumer reports, and they tell you what price you should offer the dealer. And then you go in, and you don't want the dealer to talk you out of A, the car you want, and B, the price you want to pay. And you just have to steel yourself, and you have to say, I'll go to another dealer. I'll get the price I want. And of course you will. Jan did everything to perfection, bought the car she wanted at the price she decided she was going to pay, and was in charge of the whole operation from beginning to end. See, this is what happens when religion becomes a consumer enterprise. When you do marketing tests to find out what people want, when you attempt to meet needs of the consumer out there, American Christianity, with its four churches on every little town street corner, has turned religion into a consumer enterprise. And of course, this is the reason why we hear so little about conversion. Equally little about anything resembling truth. Is it quite possible, you see, that the church ought to be about something true, like this young man in Berlin or in Leipzig said to me, the church is an island of truth and freedom. Coming here is like emigrating, he said, without leaving the country. One of the neat things about my experience of Christianity in East Germany was it was quite clear that the church and the culture were not the same thing. And to become part of the church was to become converted. The woman in the train car said to me in East Germany, there are no advantages to being baptized. And that was exactly right. Her child would not get into this swimming program, would not get special instruction, would not be part of the state-sponsored team. In fact, if teachers and pupils were known to be churchly in East Germany, they were ridiculed in class, and the teachers might in fact lose their jobs. There was no way that anybody could imagine, you see, that becoming a Christian, being baptized, was going to give you advantages. Well, there is no ability to convert. You don't convert somebody to buying a Ford if they're insisting on buying a Chevrolet or a Toyota or whatever. The consumer knows what he or she wants. You buy it, you pay for it. That's all there is. What then is available to us? Well, you again, don't ask me for trends. I'm not reporting on you to you a big trend to return to Christian baptism now. But I am saying what ought to be. And I think we ought to take that with some seriousness. What is Christian baptism about? I want to start with some stuff from Walter Brueggemann. He's got some wonderful things to say here. This is his paragraph on Christian baptism. He says, we must recover the focal drama of baptism, which is a subversive act of renunciation and embrace. The claims of the gospel of God's hidden, decisive victory are fully voiced in the language of baptism, but we are mostly so kept and domesticated that we cringe from the very news given us. We find ways to skew our language and to trivialize the sacrament so that there is nothing left for us except accommodation to our culture. See, that's in a sense what's happened to Christian baptism. In the second chapter of this really and truly wonderful book, where he talks about outsiders becoming insiders, he begins by saying that as Israel lived in Canaan, the word Canaanite, are those who were committed to social practices which were viewed as hostile to the covenantal calling and vision of Israel. And now, and he begins this chapter by talking about an outsider as one who lives by a different narrative, a different story than the narrative of the Christian community. I think the first thing that has to be said is that any community has a common story. That's in fact what makes a community, that you have a common story. I get on an airplane and I'm in the same space with 135 other people on a 727. We do not become a community. We sit there, we eat our food, we get off, we go our separate ways. Nothing communal has happened. I can even live in an area. In fact, this is one of the things that people began to discover about apartment dwellers. They didn't want to know each other. That's why they lived in apartments. So you can live in these multi-story buildings and not know anybody else who's in the building. I was on a flight to Rhinelander, Wisconsin once that was memorable. When we got on in Chicago, the stewardess said, this flight is going to Madison, Oshkosh, and Rhinelander. If these cities are not in your plans today, this would be a good time to get off the plane. Then she said, she did all the announcements, you know, if you're traveling with a child or an adult who acts like a child, put your mask on first and then do it. Or, and then she said, there's no smoking on this aircraft. Of course, if anybody's got smoking, we'll ask you to step outside. And we laughed and laughed and laughed. I mean, I just remembered that little patter because it was so different from what we usually heard. It was one of those days where a weather system was crossing from west to east over Wisconsin, and we were flying north to south. And we bounced around up there. It was just awful. There was no beverage service that day. I thought, oh, martinis, where are you when we need you? So, and I'm terrified anyway. I hate to fly, and I don't like this bouncing around up there. And so I'm just talking to pass the time and gripping my seat. And it turns out that the plane is full of Borden salesmen who had won a trip to Rhinelander, a week in Rhinelander, as a prize. You know, I know what you're thinking. Second prize was 2 weeks in Rhinelander. Actually, Rhinelander turned out to be a very nice place, lots of golf courses and everything, and there was a clergy conference up there. When we got off the plane to pick up our luggage in Rhinelander, we stood around and talked with each other because we had all been part of a shared experience. Something had happened to us. Now, we do not have annual reunions of that flight or anything of the sort, but you understand the point I'm trying to make, namely, what makes us a community is a shared happening, something that gives us a shared story. My high school class, you see, gets together. What do? When we have a class reunion, we talk about all the stuff we did back in high school, because that's our shared story, do you see? Had a seminary class reunion a couple of 2 years ago. I just got some pictures of it from Ellie. And what did we do? We told stories about the professor in whose class we used to play cliche baseball. He thought in cliches, this poor man. It was the worst course I ever have taken in my life. And we invented a baseball game. Actually, Martin Marty had done that. Invented a baseball game and assigned hit values to each of this man's cliches, you know? And when it was your turn at bat, you raised your hand and asked a question designed to elicit maximum cliches. And I know this poor man once wondered every once in a while when he'd get cheered in class because he just hit a home run with the bases loaded. So this was our shared story. I tell this at seminary, and I worry if I ever catch them applauding something I said. See, our community, the community of a class, will die with us. I mean, when we're dead, the class of 1946 or 54 will be gone. But there are communities that have continuity in time, that are able to transmit a story from one generation to another. Families, right, belong to that. Family histories, family reunions are different from, let's say, class reunions. And the church belongs in this latter category. It has a story, something that it transmits from one generation to another. Going to talk more about this on Saturday and what it means to transmit our story to our children. But for the moment, let us recognize that to baptize someone is to baptize them into a community with a quite specific story. Only in this case, the story will not just be different. My family story is different from the Kinsley family story, I'm sure. But they're not in conflict with each other. The church's story, because it is about God, will be in conflict with stories that have little or nothing to do with God's story in the world. And suppose we say that the larger culture out there is dominated by a fundamental story about death having the last word. think about this for a moment. You see, what we do in larger political communities is protect ourselves as best we can from the possibilities of death. That's what police are about. I'm not saying we shouldn't have them. Hear me right. But that's what's going on out there. That's what national defense is about. See, Congress will cut anything except our national defense because we're going to protect ourselves. This is all about death, about our ability, as General Patton said, not to sacrifice our lives for our country, but to make the other guy sacrifice his life, you see, for his. We want to deal in death so that we can protect ourselves. That's what competition is about. The whole capitalist system is about the survival of the fit and the death of our opposition. So to keep our jobs, you see, what we do is we go around and we say, how can I protect myself in this big corporation? How can I keep my job? How can I advance up the ladder? I mean, the world around us is a world dominated by the powers of death, and therefore also the powers of sin. To be called out of that and to be called into the community in which Jesus has the last word, you see, and not the defense department. That requires a conversion of major magnitude. So, baptism. The first thing is that we get a name, not our name, but Christ's name. Christening does not mean giving a ship a name. I called it christening. See, if I'd said christening, what would you have thought of? Champagne on the bow of a ship, right? Giving it its name, the John F. Kennedy aircraft carrier. Or the big controversy was over naming a battle cruiser Corpus Christi, Body of Christ. How did they get out from under that? They finally called it the City of Corpus Christi. That's how they christened that one. But christening means you get Christ's name laid upon you. What does that mean? A name is nothing other than my narrative, my story. So Walter Bowman doesn't mean anything except born 1929, grew up southwestern Minnesota, county that was 90% Lutheran, etc. I could tell you my whole story, bore you to tears, but that's what my name is. It is my narrative. To get Christ's name is to have the narrative of Jesus and his Father and their Spirit laid on me. And I become a community determined by that name. This is why arguments over the name of God are important, and why any old name won't do for God, but only the name that starts with Jesus and includes his Father and their Spirit. See, that's why when we have words like Father, Mother, or Mother, Father to address God, we have a different God than the Christian God. See, that's what's at issue in the discussion and the argument over the name of God. We are baptized not into Father, Mother, or Mother, Father, but into the name of the Father, of Jesus, his Father, and their Spirit. That's the only name that Christians know. So the first thing to be said is, into what name are we baptized? The second thing is, why do this with water? Because we are washed, or even more important, drowned in that water. That is, something about us dies and a new identity emerges. The third thing is that there is renunciation involved. In the baptismal rite in every church, you are asked to renounce the devil and the devil's empty promises. I often wondered what we would do. A friend of mine, Willard Burson, New Guinea, after 7 years of instruction, baptized a whole village in New Guinea, and on the day before, they smashed their idols. I've often thought, what would we smash at our baptisms? A television set, maybe? Bash! I renounce you, television and all your values, false advertising, etc., etc. And then there is entry into a community. In the ancient baptismal rites, people are then led into the new community where immediately they participate in the meal. They share the food with everyone. And finally, baptism will complicate your life. See, it doesn't simplify your life, it complicates it, because now you are going to be plunged into conflict. Let me just read a great baptismal section for you, Colossians 3, and you will see exactly what's going on. So then, if you have been raised with Christ, that is, taken into his story, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, is revealed, you will be revealed with him in glory. Put to death, now this is written to Christians, put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly, fornication, impurity, passion, greed, which is idolatry. These are the ways you once followed when you were living that life. Now you get rid of such things, anger, wrath, malice, slander, abusive language. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourselves with a new self. You are no longer Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free. Christ is all in all. As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, patience. Bear with one another. And if anyone has a complaint, forgive each other, just as the Lord has forgiven you. So on. See what's going on here. Nobody is talking about how one is converted, but it is quite clear that we are converted from something to something. And now the struggle throughout life between all of these things. Mine are with anger and wrath and malice and other things. So what we need to say to people is, you are not set into a community that has achieved perfection. You are set into a community that knows what the struggle is about. Outside that community, we will just go along to get along, right? In the church, we begin to discover that there are decisions to be made about what we can do at work and not do, what we can do in recreation and not do, what we can do in foreign policy as citizens of America and not do. See, it's my Christianity that keeps me writing to my congressman all the time about issues that he doesn't like to hear about. His name is John Kasich, and he's very much in the news. He's the chairman of the House Budget Committee, and he doesn't like to get letters from me. Partly because he's also a pious Christian, and so I write to him and tell him stuff like Colossians. Now, the last point I want to make, how is this the church's evangelism sacrament? The secret lies in baptismal sponsors. Baptismal sponsors. Now, we've, again, so trivialized baptism that sponsorship sort of means passing out honors among relatives. It's your turn. My wife's sister and my brother will be the sponsors, etc. Well, I would call those honorary sponsors, like at burials you sometimes have honorary pallbearers. But the real sponsor is someone in the congregation who goes looking for a person to sponsor. That's the secret. That's the key. People in the community already look among their friends, their relatives, or anywhere for people whom they can sponsor for baptism. Now, what does this mean? It means if the people are adults, getting them so acquainted with Christianity that they begin to see what's clearly at stake. Good question to ask is, could anybody catch Christianity from you? I don't know. But mainly, sponsoring people before baptism means they follow you around and get to ask, what difference does it make in your life that you are a Christian? What difference does it make that you are a Christian? See, how would you answer that question if somebody outside the church put it to you? Does it make any difference when you vote? Does it make any difference when you read a newspaper? Does it make any difference when you watch television? Does it make any difference where you work, you see? And so what are the costs? What are the prices? What difference does it make that you are a Christian? That's what outsiders have a right to ask. People, we can train ourselves. We need to introduce the outsider to the worshiping community. We need to say, this is what's going on here. We need to be able to say what difference Christianity makes, and we need to lead them, bring them to someone who can teach them what Christian teaching is. I wonder what would happen, you see, if each of us were looking somewhere for somebody to sponsor. If you're sponsoring an infant or a young child, then you say, I'll be available later on to be a friend, a mentor, a guide. Same kinds of questions. This is what Christian worship is. This is what Christian life is. And this is what Christian teaching is. But I think that's the way baptism then gets at the center of the church's evangelizing. We are going to bring people to this washing, naming, renouncing, complicating ritual. Well, sorry I went on almost to the end, but I'm open to your questions or comments or anything you want to say at this point. Yeah. Yes.
I understand what you said, but some of that I don't see how it applies to an infant. It complicates, for instance. How does it complicate a 2-month-old infant?
Right.
And for that reason, and the wife and I get discussions about this, that's why I go toward baptism at quote-unquote, the age of accountability. I don't see how they can apply to an infant.
That's right. See, I think one of the things that we have done in the church is to assume that normal baptism is the baptism of infants and that the exception will be the baptism of adults. I think it's the other way around. I think normally we're going to baptize older children and adults. And under certain circumstances, we may also baptize infants.
And it sort of sickens me when I mean, that's too strong a word, but
no, go ahead.
See families come in. We never see them in the church before. They come in, the infant's baptized, and everybody greets them, and we never see them again.
Yeah.
Until confirmation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe.
Well, I'm going to talk more about this on Saturday when we talk about transmitting the faith to the next generation. One of the most bizarre incidents, I'm just going to tell you this, I was in Canada, Niagara Falls, Canada, for a meeting of the Anglican Lutheran International Commission. And on Sunday morning, we went to a Lutheran church for worship, all of us, big group of people. And as the service began, there were a group of people sitting in front, obviously family, because the service began with a baptism. And the moment the baptism was over, we all participated in it, three rows of people right in the front got up and marched out. They did not stay for the rest of the service. The pastor, after, we were all just flabbergasted. And the pastor afterwards said he did not know this was going to happen. And never in his life had anything like that ever happened to him before. But three full pews of people just arose, marched out with the parents and the baptized baby. Now, see, this is why the issue is that under normal circumstances, the church is going to baptize at an older age. Under certain circumstances, it may also baptize infants. But I think that raises the question: what is the justification? Now, I think it is that parents can in fact make certain decisions about and for their children. When Jan and I had our sons, we made a decision that they were going to learn foreign languages while they were young. And they all learned German, and they were going to learn musical instruments when they were young. They didn't have any choice about that. They were going to learn, and they all did, play the piano, play the violin, play all kinds of instruments. We made those decisions. We also made the decision that we were going to have them baptized into the community with all that that implied. And so we started reading scripture to them, started reading the C.S. Lewis stories to them, and the implications of all that. Among other things, we never had a military toy in the house. No guns, no water pistols, nothing. And we tried to teach them also not to fight back at school, at some cost to them, I should add. All of them. Lots of things. Ridicule was the least, sometimes actual physical punishment. But so we said, because we baptized you, these are the things we are doing for you and with you and teaching you. And I think it can be done with children. We'll talk about that on Saturday. But that's the issue. And it isn't just, I think what the church is engaged in right now is what Brueggemann calls trivializing baptism, see, and doing what I would even call promiscuous baptizing. That is, sort of saying, "Well, come along, anybody here." And I think it's a real problem for the church. Please.
Yes. Do I understand you said that you baptize your children as infants?
Yes.
Well, then I think it did make a difference to them then.
Yes.
You made a commitment as parents, and possibly their sponsors made a commitment at
yes.
the time to bring them up as Christians.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say,
yeah.
That it does make a difference.
In some cases. If all the things are lined up right, but my concern is often they're not.
Well, for adults too, though.
Pardon?
I mean, that's true. The same is true.
Yeah. But I was going to say I could give you equal stories of adults who just sort of got talked into doing something that they really didn't want to do, but to please the spouse
or somebody.
But
they still are able
somebody.
To think, and they may be coerced or intimidated into doing it, but they can still they still have that responsibility to think it through, and they may blow it. But the infant doesn't have any choice in that because it can't.
Well, what I'm trying to say here is what baptism ought to be, not what it is.
Right.
Here, you had your
baptism a gift. I mean, isn't it? It's more of a gift than something that you just do.
You decide.
I mean, instead of you just deciding to do it, it's the gift. And then, as you grow up with your sponsors and parents, what happens with that? Then you can make that choice again later on. If you just say forget it, but I mean, it is a gift from God.
Yes, in the same sense that the reign of God is a gift, but the reign of God plunges us then into conflict, A, with a lot of stuff that's in ourselves, and B, with a lot of stuff that's out there in the society and in the world. And so it's a gift of a peculiar kind, in East Germany, the woman was right. To have her daughter baptized was not going to do her any favors. There were no advantages in that society. But I think, see, I believe that the reign of God is what ought to be. It is God's intention, and it is finally what will be. And yes, it's an enormous gift, but it's also one that's going to plunge us into conflict with the reign of death all around us.
You may have talked about this yesterday, but with the church growth movement and new ways of evangelizing and so on, the emphasis is on, seems to be on getting people in the door, making them comfortable or whatever. But what happens after that? And I'm really ignorant about that. With this new approach. I mean, do they go on then to really talk about what baptism means and what the conflicts are and what the struggles are?
I hope so. And I think, for example, that that's Robert Schuller's intention. But Robert Schuller will also tell you that it doesn't always get to that point with many people. Because what they see on Sunday morning then turns out to be not what membership in the church is finally about.